me. When I tried to get past him again, he stopped me with only a dark look. If you so much as sway in the saddle, I'm bringing you home. Understood? Understood. Downstairs, I headed for the dining room, but Matthew pulled me in the other direction. Let's eat in the kitchens, he said quietly. No formal breakfast with Isabeau staring at me over Le Monde. That was welcome news. We ate in what were ostensibly the housekeeper's rooms, in front of a blazing fire at a table set for two, though I would be the only one eating Mart's excellent, abundant food. A huge pot of tea sat on the scarred, round wooden table, wrapped in a linen towel to keep it hot. Mart glanced at me with concern, tutting at my dark circles and pale skin. When my fork slowed, Matthew reached for a pyramid of boxes crowned with a black velvet-covered helmet. For you, he said, putting them on the table. The helmet was self-explanatory. It was shaped like a high-crowned baseball hat, with a fold of black grosgrain ribbon at the nape. Despite its velvet covering and ribbon, the helmet was sturdy and made expressly to keep soft human skulls from cracking if they met with the ground. I hated them, but it was a wise precaution. Thank you, I said. What's in the boxes? Open them and see. The first box held a pair of black breeches with suede patches inside the knees to grip the saddle. They would be far more pleasant to ride in than my thin, slippery leggings, and looked like they would fit, too. Matthew must have been making more phone calls and relaying approximate measurements while I napped. I smiled at him in gratitude. The box also held a black padded vest with a long tail and stiff metal supports sewn into the seams. It looked and would no doubt feel like a turtle shell, uncomfortable and unwieldy. This isn't necessary. I held it up, frowning. It is if you're going riding. His voice didn't show the slightest hint of emotion. You tell me you're experienced. If so, you won't have a problem adjusting to its weight. My color rose, and my fingertips gave a warning tingle. Matthew watched me with interest, and Mart came to the door and gave a sniff. I breathed in and out until the tingling stopped. You are a seatbelt in my car, Matthew said evenly. You'll wear a vest on my horse. We stared at each other in a standoff of wills. The thought of the fresh air defeated me, and Mart's eyes glittered with amusement. No doubt our negotiations were as much fun to watch as were the volleys between Matthew and Isabeau. I pulled the final box toward me in silent concession. It was long and heavy, and there was a sharp tang of leather when the lid lifted. Boots. Knee-length, black boots. I'd never shown horses and had limited resources, so I'd never owned a proper pair of riding boots. These were beautiful, with their curved calves and supple leather. My fingers touched their shining surfaces. Thank you, I breathed, delighted with his surprise. I'm pretty sure they'll fit, Matthew said, his eyes soft.
Come, girl, Mart said cheerfully from the door. You change.
She barely got me into the laundry room before I'd kicked off my loafers and peeled the leggings from my body. She took the worn lycra and cotton from me while I wriggled into the breeches.
There was a time when women didn't ride like men, Mart said, looking at the muscles in my legs and shaking her head.
Matthew was on his phone when I returned, sending out instructions to all the other people in his world who required his management. He looked up with approval.
Those will be more comfortable.
He stood and picked up the boots.
There's no jack in here. You'll have to wear your other shoes to the stables.
No, I want to put them on now, I said, fingers outstretched.
Sit down, then.
He shook his head at my impatience. You'll never get them on the first time without help. Matthew picked up my chair with me in it and turned it so he had more room to maneuver. He held out the right boot, and I stuck my foot in as far as the ankle. He was right. No amount of tugging was going to get my foot around the stiff bend. He stood over my foot, grasping the heel and toe of the boot and wriggling it gently as I pulled the leather in the other direction. After several minutes of struggle, my foot worked its way into the shank.
Matthew gave the sole a final, firm push, and the boot snuggled against my bones. Once both boots were on, I held my legs out to admire. Matthew tugged and patted, sliding his cold fingers around the top rim to make sure my blood could circulate. I stood, my legs feeling unusually long, took a few stiff-ankled steps, and did a little twirl. "Thank you." I threw my arms around his neck, the toes of my boots grazing the floor. I love them. Matthew carried my vest and hat to the stables, much as he had carried my computer and yoga mat in Oxford. The stable doors were flung open, and there were sounds of activity. "George?" Matthew called. A small, wiry man of indeterminate age, though not a vampire, came around the corner, carrying a bridle and a curry comb. When we passed Balthazar's stall, the stallion stomped angrily and tossed his head. "You promised," he seemed to say. Inside my pocket was a tiny apple that I'd wheedled from Mart. "Here you go, baby," I said, holding it out on a flat palm. Matthew watched warily as Balthazar extended his neck and reached with delicate lips to pick the fruit from my hand. Once it was in his mouth, he looked at his owner triumphantly. "Yes, I see that you're behaving like a prince," Matthew said dryly, "but that doesn't mean you won't behave like a devil at the first opportunity." Balthazar's hooves struck the ground in annoyance. We passed by the tack room. In addition to the regular saddles, bridles, and reins, there were freestanding wooden frames that held something like a small armchair with odd supports on one side. "What are they?" "Side saddles," Matthew said, kicking off his shoes and stepping into a tall pair of well-worn boots. His foot slid down easily with a simple stamp on the heel and a tug at the top. "Isabeau prefers them." In the paddock, Dar and Rakasa turned their heads and looked with interest while George and Matthew began a detailed discussion of all the natural obstacles we might encounter. I held my palm out to Dar, sorry that there were no more apples in my pocket. The gelding looked disappointed, too, once he picked up the sweet scent. "Next time," I promised. Ducking under his neck, I arrived at Rakasa's side. "Hello, beauty." Rakasa picked up her right front foot and cocked her head toward me. I ran my hands over her neck and shoulders, getting her used to my scent and touch, and gave the saddle a tug, checking the tightness of the girth strap, making sure the blanket underneath was smooth. She reached around and gave me an inquiring smell and a snuffle, nosing at my pullover where the apple had been. She tossed her head in indignation. "You too," I promised her with a laugh, placing my left hand firmly on her rump. "Let's have a look." Horses like having their feet touched about as much as most witches like being dunked in water, which is to say, not much. But out of habit and superstition, I'd never ridden a horse without first checking to make sure that nothing was lodged in their soft hooves. When I straightened, the two men were watching me closely. George said something to indicate I would do. Matthew nodded thoughtfully, holding out my vest and hat. The vest was snug and hard, but it wasn't as bad as I'd expected. The hat interfered with my ponytail, and I slid the elastic band lower to accommodate it before snapping the chin band together. Matthew was at my back in the time it took me to grab the reins and lift my foot to Rakasa's stirrup. "Will you never wait until I help you?" he growled into my ear. "I can get onto a horse myself," I said hotly. "But you don't need to." Matthew's hands cupped my shin, lifting me effortlessly into the saddle. After that, he checked my stirrup length, rechecked the girth strap, and finally went to his own horse. He swung into the saddle with the practiced air that suggested he'd been on horseback for hundreds of years. Once there, he looked like a king. Rakasa started to dance in impatience, and I pushed my heels down. She stopped, looking puzzled. "Quiet," I whispered. She nodded her head and stared forward, her ears working back and forth. "Take her around the paddock while I check my saddle," Matthew said casually, swinging his left knee onto Dar's shoulder and fiddling with his stirrup leather. My eyes narrowed. His stirrups needed no adjustment. He was checking out my riding skills. I walked Rakasa halfway around the paddock to feel her gait. The Andalusian really did dance, delicately picking up her feet and putting them down firmly in a beautiful rocking movement. When I pressed both heels into her sides, Rakasa's dancing walk turned into an equally rollicking smooth trot. We passed Matthew, who had given up all pretense of adjusting his saddle. George leaned against the fence, smiling broadly.
"Beautiful girl," I breathed silently. Her left ear shot back, and she picked up the pace slightly. My calf pressed into her flank, just behind the stirrup, and she broke into a canter, her feet reaching out into the air and her neck arched. How angry would Matthew be if we jumped the paddock fence?
Angry, I was sure. Rakasa rounded the corner, and I slowed her to a trot. "Well?" I demanded. George nodded and opened the paddock gate. "You have a good seat," Matthew said, eyeing my backside. "Good hands, too. You'll be all right. By the way," he continued in a conversational tone, leaning toward me and dropping his voice, "if you'd jumped the fence back there, today's outing would have been over."
Once we'd cleared the gardens and passed through the old gate, the trees thickened and Matthew scanned the forest. A few feet into the woods, he began to relax, having accounted for every creature within and discovered that none of them were of the two-legged variety. Matthew kicked Dar into a trot, and Rakasa obediently waited for me to kick her as well. I did, amazed all over again at how smoothly she moved.
"What kind of horse is Dar?" I asked, noticing his equally smooth gait.
"I suppose you'd call him a destria," Matthew explained. That was the mount that carried knights to the Crusades. He was bred for speed and agility.
"I thought destriers were enormous war horses."
Dar was bigger than Rakasa, but not much.
"They were large for the time, but they weren't big enough to carry any of the men in this family into battle, not once we had armor on our backs and weapons. We trained on horses like Dar and rode them for pleasure, but we fought on Percherons like Balthazar."
I stared between Rakasa's ears, working up the courage to broach another subject.
"May I ask you something about your mother?"
"Of course," Matthew said, twisting in his saddle. He put one fist on his hips and held his horse's reins lightly in the other hand. I now knew with absolute certainty how a medieval knight looked on horseback.
"Why does she hate witches so much?"
"Vampires and witches are traditional enemies, but Isabeau's dislike of me goes beyond that. It seems personal."
"I suppose you want a better answer than you smell like spring?"
"Yes, I want the real reason."
"She's jealous."
Matthew patted Dar's shoulder.
"What on earth is she jealous of?"
"Let's see. Your power, especially a witch's ability to see the future. Your ability to bear children and pass that power to a new generation. And the ease with which you die, I suppose," he said, his voice reflective.
"Isabeau had you and Louisa for children?"
"Yes, Isabeau made both of us, but it's not quite the same as bearing a child, I think."
"Why does she envy a witch's second sight?"
"That has to do with how Isabeau was made. Her maker didn't ask permission first."
Matthew's face darkened. He wanted her for a wife, and he just took her and turned her into a vampire. She had a reputation as a seer, and was young enough to still hope for children. When she became a vampire, both of those abilities were gone. She's never quite gotten over it, and witches are a constant reminder of the life she's lost.
"Why does she envy that witches die so easily?"
"Because she misses my father."
He abruptly stopped talking, and it was clear I'd pressed him enough. The trees thinned, and Rakasa's ears shot back and forth impatiently.
"Go ahead," he said with resignation, gesturing at the open field before us.
Rakasa leaped forward at the touch of my heels, catching the bit in her teeth. She slowed climbing the hill, and once on the crest she pranced and tossed her head, clearly enjoying the fact that Dar was standing at the bottom while she was on top. I circled her into a fast figure eight, changing her leads on the fly to keep her from stumbling as she went around corners. Dar took off. Not at a canter, but a gallop, his black tail streaming out behind him and his hooves striking the earth with unbelievable speed. I gasped and pulled lightly on Rakasa's reins to make her stop. So that was the point of destriers. They could go from 0 to 60 like a finely tuned sports car. Matthew made no effort to slow his horse as he approached, but Dar stopped on a dime about 6 feet away from us, his sides bowed out slightly with exertion.
"Show off? You won't let me jump a fence and you put on that display?" I teased.
"Dar doesn't get enough exercise either. This is exactly what he needs." Matthew grinned and patted his horse on the shoulder.
"Are you interested in a race?"
"We'll give you a head start, of course," he said with a courtly bow.
"You're on."
"Where to?" Matthew pointed to a solitary tree on the top of the ridge and watched me, alert for the first indication of movement. He'd picked something that you could shoot past without running into anything. Maybe Rakasa wasn't as good at abrupt stops as Dar was. There was no way I was going to surprise a vampire, and no way my horse, for all her smooth gait, was going to beat Dar up the ridge. Still, I was eager to see how well she would perform. I leaned forward and patted Rakasa on the neck, resting my chin for just a moment on her warm flesh and closing my eyes. "Fly," I encouraged her silently. Rakasa shot forward as if she'd been slapped on the rump, and my instincts took over. I lifted myself out of the saddle to make it easier for her to carry my weight, tying a loose knot in the reins. When her speed stabilized, I lowered myself into the saddle, clutching her warm body between my legs. My feet kicked free from the unnecessary stirrups, and my fingers wove through her mane. Matthew and Dar thundered behind us. It was like my dream, the one where dogs and horses were chasing me. My left hand curled as if holding something, and I bent low along Rakasa's neck, eyes closed. "Fly," I repeated, but the voice in my head no longer sounded like my own. Rakasa responded with still more speed. I felt the tree grow closer. Matthew swore an Occitan and Rakasa swerved to the left at the last minute, slowing to a canter and then a trot. There was a tug on her reins. My eyes shot open in alarm. "Do you always ride unfamiliar horses at top speed, with your eyes closed, no reins and no stirrups?" Matthew's voice was coldly furious. "You row with your eyes closed, I've seen you. And you walk with them closed, too. I've always suspected that magic was involved. And you must use your power to ride as well, otherwise you'd be dead. And for what it's worth, I believe you're telling Rakasa what to do with your mind and not with your hands and legs." I wondered if what he said was true. Matthew made an impatient sound and dismounted by swinging his right leg high over Dar's head, kicking his left foot out of the stirrup, and sliding down the horse's side facing front. "Get down from there," he said roughly, grabbing Rakasa's loose reins. Dismounting the traditional way, I swung my right leg over Rakasa's rump. When my back was to him, Matthew reached up and scooped me off the horse. Now I knew why he preferred to face front. It kept you from being grabbed from behind and hauled off your mount. He turned me around and crushed me to his chest. "Dieu," he whispered into my hair. "Don't do anything like that again, please."
"You told me not to worry about what I was doing. It's why you brought me to France," I said, confused by his reaction.
"I'm sorry," he said earnestly. "I'm trying not to interfere. But it's difficult to watch you using powers you don't understand, especially when you're not aware you're doing it." Matthew left me to tend to the horses, tying their reins so that they wouldn't step on them, but giving them the freedom to nibble the sparse fall grass. When he returned, his face was somber. "There's something I need to show you." He led me to the tree and we sat underneath it. I folded my legs carefully to the side so that my boots didn't cut into my legs. Matthew simply dropped, his knees on the ground and his feet curled under his thighs. He reached into the pocket of his breeches and drew out a piece of paper with black and gray bars on a white background. It had been folded and refolded several times. It was a DNA report. "Mine?"
"Yours."
When?
My fingers traced the bars along the page. Marcus brought the results to New College. I didn't want to share them with you so soon after you were reminded of your parents' death. He hesitated. Was I right to wait? When I nodded, Matthew looked relieved. What does it say? I asked. We don't understand everything, he replied slowly. But Marcus and Miriam did identify markers in your DNA that we've seen before. Miriam's tiny, precise handwriting marched down the left side of the page, and the bars, some circled with red pen, marched down the right. This is the genetic marker for precognition, Matthew continued, pointing to the first circled smudge. His finger began slowly moving down the page. This one is for flight. This helps witches find things that are lost. Matthew kept reeling off powers and abilities one at a time until my head spun. This one is for talking with the dead. This is for transmogrification. This is telekinesis. This is spell casting. This one is charms. This one is curses. And you've got mind reading, telepathy, and empathy, the next to one another. This can't be right. I'd never heard of a witch with more than one or two powers. Matthew had already reached a dozen. I think the findings are right, Diana. These powers may never manifest, but you've inherited the genetic predisposition for them. He flipped the page. There were more red circles and more careful annotations by Miriam. Here are the elemental markers. Earth is present in almost all witches, and some have either earth and air or earth and water. You've got all three, which we've never seen before. And you've also got fire. Fire is very, very rare. Matthew pointed to the four smudges. What are elemental markers? My feet were feeling uncomfortably breezy and my fingers were tingling. Indications that you had the genetic predisposition to control one or more of the elements. They explain why you could raise a witch wind. Based on this, you could command witch fire and what's called witch water as well. What does earth do? Herbal magic, the power to affect growing things, the basics. Combined with spell casting, cursing, and charms, or any one of them really, it means you have not only powerful magical abilities, but an innate talent for witchcraft. My aunt was good with spells. Emily wasn't, but could fly for short distances and see the future. These were classic differences among witches, dividing those who used witchcraft, like Sarah, from those who used magic. It all boiled down to whether words shaped your power or whether you just had it and could wield it as you liked. I buried my face in my hands. The prospect of seeing the future as my mother could had been scary enough. Control of the elements? Talking with the dead? There is a long list of powers on that sheet. We've only seen, what, four or five of them? It was terrifying. I suspect we've seen more than that. Like the way you move with your eyes closed, your ability to communicate with Rakasa, and your sparkly fingers. We just don't have names for them yet. Please tell me that's all. Matthew hesitated. Not quite. He flipped to another page. We can't yet identify these markers. In most cases, we have to correlate accounts of a witch's activities, some of them centuries old, with DNA evidence. It can be hard to match them up. Do the tests explain why my magic is emerging now? We don't need a test for that. Your magic is behaving as if it's waking after a long sleep. All that inactivity has made it restless, and now it wants to have its way. Blood will out, Matthew said lightly. He rocked gracefully to his feet and lifted me up. You'll catch cold sitting on the ground, and I'll have a hell of a time explaining myself to Mart if you get sick. He whistled to the horses. They strolled in our direction, still munching on their unexpected treat. We rode for another hour, exploring the woods and fields around Set Tour. Matthew pointed out the best place to hunt rabbits, and where his father had taught him to shoot a crossbow without taking out his own eye. When we turned back to the stables, my worries over the test results had been replaced with a pleasant feeling of exhaustion. My muscles will be sore tomorrow, I said, groaning. I haven't been on a horse for years. Nobody would have guessed that from the way you rode today, he said.
We passed out of the forest and entered the chateau's stone gate. You're a good rider, Diana, but you mustn't go out by yourself. It's too easy to lose your way.
Matthew wasn't worried I'd get lost. He was worried I'd be found.
I won't. His long fingers relaxed on the reins. He'd been clutching them for the past 5 minutes. This vampire was used to giving orders that were obeyed instantly. He wasn't accustomed to making requests and negotiating agreements. And his usual quick temper was nowhere in evidence. Sidling Rakasa closer to Dar, I reached over and raised Matthew's palm to my mouth. My lips were warm against his hard, cold flesh. His pupils dilated in surprise. I let go, and, clucking Rakasa forward, headed into the stables. Chapter 20. Isabeau was mercifully absent at lunch. Afterward, I wanted to go straight to Matthew's study and start examining Aurora Consurgence, but he convinced me to take a bath first. It would, he promised, make the inevitable muscle stiffness more bearable. Halfway upstairs, I had to stop and rub a cramp in my leg. I was going to pay for the morning's enthusiasm. The bath was heavenly, long, hot, and relaxing. I put on loose black trousers, a sweater, and a pair of socks and padded downstairs, where a fire was blazing. My flesh turned orange and red as I held my hands out to the flames. What would it be like to control fire? My fingers tingled in response to the question, and I slid them safely into my pockets. Matthew looked up from his desk. Your manuscript is next to your computer. Its black covers drew me as surely as a magnet. I sat down at the table and opened them, holding the book carefully. The colors were even brighter than I remembered. After staring at the queen for several minutes, I turned to the first page. Incipit Tractatus Aurora Consurgence Initialatus. The words were familiar. Here begins the treatise, called The Rising of the Dawn. But I still felt the shiver of pleasure associated with seeing a manuscript for the first time. Everything good comes to me along with her. She is known as the Wisdom of the South, who calls it out in the streets and to the multitudes. I read silently, translating from the Latin. It was a beautiful work, full of paraphrases from scripture as well as other texts. Do you have a Bible up here? It would be wise for me to have one handy as I made my way through the manuscript. Yes, but I'm not sure where it is. Do you want me to look for it? Matthew rose slightly from his chair, but his eyes were still glued to his computer screen. No, I'll find it. I got up and ran my finger down the edge of the nearest shelf. Matthew's books were arranged not by size, but in a running timeline. Those on the first bookshelf were so ancient that I couldn't bear to think about what they contained. The lost works of Aristotle, perhaps? Anything was possible. Roughly half of Matthew's books were shelved spine in to protect the book's fragile edges. Many of these had identifying marks written along the edges of the pages, and thick black letters spelled out a title here, an author's name there. Halfway around the room, the books began to appear spine out, their titles and authors embossed in gold and silver. I slid past the manuscripts with their thick and bumpy pages, some with small Greek letters on the front edge. I kept going, looking for a large, fat printed book. My index finger froze in front of one bound in brown leather and covered with gilding. Matthew, please tell me Biblia Sacra 1450 is not what I think it is. Okay, it's not what you think it is, he said automatically, fingers racing over the keys with more than human speed. He was paying little attention to what I was doing, and none at all to what I was saying. Leaving Gutenberg's Bible where it was, I continued along the shelves, hoping that it wasn't the only one available to me. My finger froze again at a book labeled Will's Plays. Were these books given to you by friends? Most of them. Matthew didn't even look up.
Like German printing, the early days of English drama were a subject for later discussion.
For the most part, Matthew's books were in pristine condition.
This was not entirely surprising, given their owner.
Some, though, were well worn. A slender, tall book on the bottom shelf, for instance, had corners so torn and thin you could see the wooden boards peeking through the leather.
Curious to see what had made this book a favorite, I pulled it out and opened the pages.
It was Vesalius's anatomy book from 1543, the first to depict dissected human bodies in exacting detail. Now hunting for fresh insights into Matthew, I sought out the next book to show signs of heavy use. This time it was a smaller, thicker volume. Inked into the foredge was the title De Motu, William Harvey's study of the circulation of the blood and his explanation of how the heart pumped must have been interesting reading for vampires when it was first published in the 1620s, though they must already have had some notion that this might be the case. Matthew's well-worn books included works on electricity, microscopy, and physiology, but the most battered book I'd seen yet was resting on the 19th century shelves, a first edition of Darwin's On the Origin of Species. Sneaking a glance at Matthew, I pulled the book off the shelf with the stealth of a shoplifter. Its green cloth binding, with the title and author stamped in gold, was frayed with wear. Matthew had written his name in a beautiful copperplate script on the flyleaf. There was a letter folded inside. "Dear Sir," it began, "your letter of 15 October has reached me at last. I am mortified at my slow reply. I have for many years been collecting all the facts which I could in regards to the variation and origin of species, and your approval of my reasonings comes as welcome news, as my book will soon pass into the publisher's hands." It was signed C. Darwin, and the date was 1859. The two men had been exchanging letters just weeks prior to Origen's publication in November. The book's pages were covered with the vampire's notes in pencil and ink, leaving hardly an inch of blank paper. Three chapters were annotated even more heavily than the rest. They were the chapters on instinct, hybridism, and the affinities between the species. Like Harvey's treatise on the circulation of blood, Darwin's seventh chapter on natural instincts must have been page-turning reading for vampires. Matthew had underlined specific passages and written above and below the lines, as well as in the margins as he grew more excited by Darwin's ideas. Hence we may conclude that domestic instincts have been acquired and natural instincts have been lost partly by habit and partly by man selecting and accumulating, during successive generations, peculiar mental habits and actions, which at first appeared from what we must, in our ignorance, call an accident. Matthew's scribbled remarks included questions about which instincts might have been acquired and whether accidents were possible in nature. Can it be that we have maintained, as instincts, what humans have given up through accident and habit? He asked across the bottom margin. There was no need for me to ask who was included in we. He meant creatures. Not just vampires, but witches and demons, too. In the chapter on hybridism, Matthew's interest had been caught by the problems of crossbreeding and sterility. First crosses between forms sufficiently distinct to be ranked as species and their hybrids, Darwin wrote, are very generally but not universally sterile. A sketch of a family tree crowded the margins next to the underlined passage. There was a question mark where the roots belonged and four branches. Why has inbreeding not led to sterility or madness? Matthew wondered in the tree's trunk. At the top of the page he had written, "One species or four?" and "Comment sont faites les dios?" I traced the writing with my finger. This was my specialty, turning the scribbles of scientists into something sensible to everyone else. In his last note, Matthew had used a familiar technique to hide his thoughts. He'd written in a combination of French and Latin, and used an archaic abbreviation for demons for good measure, in which the consonants, save the first and last, had been replaced with lines over the vowels. That way, No one paging through his book would see the word demons and stop for a closer look. How are demons made? Matthew had wondered in 1859. He was still looking for the answer a century and a half later. When Darwin began discussing the affinities between species, Matthew's pen had been unable to stop racing across the page, making it nearly impossible to read the printed text. Against a passage explaining, "From the first dawn of life, all organic beings are found to resemble each other in descending degrees, so that they can be classed in groups under groups." Matthew had written "Origins" in large black letters. A few lines down, another passage had been underlined twice. The existence of groups would have been of simple signification if one group had been exclusively fitted to inhabit the land and another the water. One to feed on flesh, another on vegetable matter, and so on. But the case is widely different in nature, for it is notorious how commonly members of even the same subgroup have different habits. Did Matthew believe that the vampire diet was a habit rather than a defining characteristic of the species? Reading on, I found the next clue. Finally, the several classes of facts which have been considered in this chapter seemed to me to proclaim so plainly that the innumerable species, genera, and families of organic beings with which this world is peopled have all descended, each within its own class or group, from common parents, and have all been modified in the course of descent. In the margins, Matthew had written, "Common parents," and "Ce qui explique tout." The vampire believed that monogenesis explained everything, or at least he had in 1859. Matthew thought it was possible that demons, humans, vampires, and witches shared common ancestors. Our considerable differences were matters of descent, habit, and selection. He had evaded me in his laboratory when I asked whether we were one species or four, but he couldn't do so in his library. Matthew remained fixated on his computer. Closing the covers of Aurora Consurgence to protect its pages, and abandoning my search for a more ordinary Bible, I carried his copy of Darwin to the fire and curled up on the sofa. I opened it, intending to try to make sense of the vampire based on the notes he'd made in his book. He was still a mystery to me, perhaps even more so here at Settur. Matthew in France was different from Matthew in England. He'd never lost himself in his work this way. Here, his shoulders weren't fiercely squared but relaxed, and he'd caught his lower lip in his slightly elongated sharp cuspid as he typed. It was a sign of concentration, as was the crease between his eyes. Matthew was oblivious to my attention, his fingers flying over the keys, clattering on the computer with a considerable amount of force. He must go through laptops at quite a rate, given their delicate plastic parts. He reached the end of a sentence, leaned back in his chair, and stretched. Then he yawned. I'd never seen him yawn before. Was his yawn, like his lowered shoulders, a sign of relaxation? The day after we'd first met, Matthew had told me that he liked to know his environment. Here, he knew every inch of the place. Every smell was familiar, as was every creature who roamed nearby. And then there was his relationship with his mother and Mart. They were a family, this odd assortment of vampires, and they had taken me in for Matthew's sake. I turned back to Darwin, but the bath, the warm fire, and the constant background noise of his clacking fingers lulled me to sleep. I woke up covered with a blanket, on the Origin of Species lying on the floor nearby, neatly closed with a slip of paper marking my place. I flushed. I'd been caught snooping. "Good evening," Matthew said from the sofa opposite. He slid a piece of paper into the book that he was reading and rested it on his knee. "Can I interest you in some wine?" Wine sounded very, very good. "Yes, please." Matthew went to a small 18th-century table near the landing. There was a bottle with no label, the cork pulled and lying at its side. He poured two glasses and carried one to me before he sat down. I sniffed, anticipating his first question. "Raspberries and rocks." "For a witch, you're really quite good at this."
Matthew nodded in approval. "What is it that I'm drinking?" I asked, taking a sip. "Is it ancient? Rare?" Matthew put his head back and laughed. "Neither. It was probably put in the bottle about 5 months ago. It's a local wine, from vineyards down the road. Nothing fancy, nothing special." It may not have been fancy or special, but it was fresh and tasted woody and earthy, like the air around Set Tour. "I see that you gave up your search for a Bible in favor of something more scientific. Were you enjoying Darwin?" he asked mildly after watching me drink for a few moments. "Do you still believe that creatures and humans are descended from common parents? Is it really possible that the differences between us are merely racial?" He made a small sound of impatience. "I told you in the lab that I didn't know. You were sure in 1859, and you thought that drinking blood might be simply a dietary habit, not a mark of differentiation. Do you know how many scientific advances have taken place between Darwin's time and today? It's a scientist's prerogative to change his mind as new information comes to light." He drank some wine and rested the glass against his knee, turning it this way and that so the firelight played on the liquid inside. "Besides, there's no longer much scientific evidence for human notions of racial distinctions. Modern research suggests that most ideas about race are nothing more than an outmoded human method for explaining easily observable differences between themselves and someone else. The question of why you're here, how we're all here, really does consume you," I said slowly. "I could see it on every page of Darwin's book." Matthew studied his wine. "It's the only question worth asking." His voice was soft, but his profile was stern, with its sharp lines and heavy brow. I wanted to smooth the lines and lift his features into a smile, but remained seated while the firelight danced over his white skin and dark hair. Matthew picked up his book again, cradling it in one set of long fingers while his wine glass rested in the other. I stared at the fire as the light dimmed. When a clock on the desk struck 7, Matthew put down his book. "Should we join Isabeau in the salon before dinner?" "Yes," I replied, squaring my shoulders slightly. "But let me change first." My wardrobe couldn't hold a candle to Isabeau's, but I didn't want Matthew to be completely ashamed of me. As ever, he looked ready for a boardroom or a Milan catwalk in a simple pair of black wool trousers and a fresh selection from his endless supply of sweaters. My recent close encounters with them had convinced me they were all cashmere, thick and luscious. Upstairs, I rooted through the items in my duffel bag and selected a gray pair of trousers and a sapphire blue sweater made out of finely spun wool, with a tight, funnel-shaped neck and bell-shaped sleeves. My hair had a wave in it thanks to my earlier bath and the fact that it had finished drying scrunched under my head on the sofa. With the minimum conditions of presentability met, I slid on my loafers and started down the stairs. Matthew's keen ears had picked up the sound of my movements, and he met me on the landing. When he saw me, his eyes lit up, and his smile was wide and slow. "I like you in blue as much as I like you in black. You look beautiful," he murmured, kissing me formally on both cheeks. The blood moved toward them as Matthew lifted my hair around my shoulders, the strands falling through his long white fingers. "Now, don't let Isabeau get under your skin, no matter what she says." "I'll try," I said with a little laugh, looking up at him uncertainly. When we reached the salon, Mart and Isabeau were already there. His mother was surrounded by newspapers written in every major European language, as well as one in Hebrew and another in Arabic. Mart, on the other hand, was reading a paperback murder mystery with a lurid cover, her black eyes darting over the lines of print with enviable speed. "Good evening, Maman," Matthew said, moving to give Isabeau a kiss on each cold cheek. Her nostrils flared as he moved his body from one side to the other, her cold eyes fixed on mine angrily. I knew it had earned me such a black look. Matthew smelled like me. "Come, girl," Mart said, patting the cushion next to her and shooting Matthew's mother a warning glance. Isabeau closed her eyes. When they opened again, the anger was gone, replaced by something like resignation. "Gab es einen anderen Tod?"
Isabeau murmured to her son as Matthew picked up Die Welt and began scanning the headlines with a sound of disgust.
Where? I asked.
Another bloodless corpse had been found. If Isabeau thought she was going to shut me out of the conversation with German, she'd better think again.
Munich, Matthew said, his face buried in the pages. Christ, why doesn't someone do something about this?
We must be careful what we wish for, Matthew,
Isabeau said. She changed the subject abruptly.
How was your idea, Anna?
Matthew peered warily at his mother over Die Welt's headlines.
It was wonderful. Thank you for letting me ride Rakasa, I replied, sitting back next to Mart and forcing myself to meet Isabeau's eyes without blinking.
She is too willful for my liking, she said, shifting her attention to her son,
who had the good sense to put his nose back in his paper.
Fidat is much more biddable. As I get older, I find that quality admirable in horses.
In sons, too, I thought. Mart smiled encouragingly at me and got up to fuss at a sideboard. She carried a large goblet of wine to Isabeau and a much smaller one to me. Mart returned to the table and came back with another glass for Matthew. He sniffed it appreciatively.
Thank you, Maman, he said, raising his glass in tribute.
It's not much,
Isabeau said, taking a sip of the same wine.
No, not much. Just one of my favorites. Thank you for remembering.
Matthew savored the wine's flavors before swallowing the liquid down.
Are all vampires as fond of wine as you are? I asked Matthew, smelling the peppery wine. You drink it all the time, and you never get the slightest bit tipsy.
Matthew grinned.
Most vampires are much fonder of it. As for getting drunk, our family has always been known for its admirable restraint, hasn't it, Maman?
Isabeau gave a most unladylike snort.
Occasionally, with respect to wine, perhaps.
You should be a diplomat, Isabeau. You're very good with a quick non-answer, I said.
Matthew shouted with laughter.
Phew, I never thought the day would come when my mother would be thought diplomatic, especially not with her tongue. Isabeau's always been much better with the diplomacy of the sword.
Mart snickered in agreement. Isabeau and I both looked indignant, which only made him shout again. The atmosphere at dinner was considerably warmer than it had been last night. Matthew sat at the head of the table, with Isabeau to his left and me at his right. Mart traveled incessantly from kitchen to fireside to table, sitting now and again to take a sip of wine and make small contributions to the conversation. Plates full of food came and went, everything from wild mushroom soup to quail to delicate slices of beef. I marveled aloud that someone who no longer ate cooked food could have such a deft hand with spices. Mart blushed and dimpled, swatting at Matthew when he tried to tell stories of her more spectacular culinary disasters.
Do you remember the live pigeon pie?
He chortled.
No one ever explained that you had to keep the birds from eating for 24 hours before you baked it, or the inside would resemble a bird bath.
That earned him a sharp tap on the back of his skull.
Matthew,
Isabeau warned, wiping the tears from her eyes after a prolonged bout of laughter.
You shouldn't bait Mart. You have had your share of disasters over the years, too. And I have seen them all,
Mart pronounced, carrying over a salad.
Her English got stronger by the hour, as she switched into the language whenever she talked in front of me. She returned to the sideboard and fetched a bowl of nuts, which she put between Matthew and Isabeau.
When you flooded the castle with your idea for capturing water on the roof, for one, she said, ticking it off on her fingers. When you forgot to collect the taxes, too. It was spring, you were bored, so you got up one morning and went to Italy to make war. Your father had to beg forgiveness from the king on his knees. And then there was New York,
she shouted triumphantly. The three vampires continued to swap reminiscences. None of them talked about Isabeau's past, though. When something came up that touched on her, or Matthew's father, or his sister, the conversation slid gracefully away. I noticed the pattern and wondered about the reasons for it, but said nothing, content to let the evening develop as they wished it to, and strangely comforted to be part of a family again, even a family of vampires. After dinner, we returned to the salon, where the fire was larger and more impressive than before. The castle's chimneys were heating up with each log thrown into the grate. The fires burned hotter, and the room almost felt warm as a result. Matthew made sure that Isabeau was comfortable, getting her yet another glass of wine, and fiddled with a nearby stereo. Mart made me tea instead, thrusting the cup and saucer into my hands. "Drink," she instructed, her eyes attentive. Isabeau watched me drink too, and gave Mart a long look.
"It will help you sleep."
"Did you make this?" It tasted of herbs and flowers. Normally I didn't like herbal tea, but this one was fresh and slightly bitter.
"Yes,"
she answered, turning up her chin at Isabeau's stare.
"I have made it for a long time. My mother taught me. I will teach you as well."
The sound of dance music filled the room, lively and rhythmic. Matthew adjusted the position of the chairs by the fireplace, clearing a spot on the floor.
"Volest dansar en bu?" Matthew asked his mother, holding out both hands.
Isabeau's smile was radiant, transforming her lovely, cold features into something indescribably beautiful. "Ok," she said, putting her tiny hands into his. The two of them took their places in front of the fire, waiting for the next song to start. When Matthew and his mother began to dance, they made Astaire and Rogers look clumsy. Their bodies came together and drew apart, turned in circles away from each other and then dipped and turned. The slightest touch from Matthew sent Isabeau reeling, and the merest hint of an undulation or a hesitation from Isabeau caused a corresponding response in him. Isabeau dipped into a graceful curtsy, and Matthew swept into a bow at the precise moment the music drew to its close. "What was that?" I asked. "It started out as a tarantella," Matthew said, escorting his mother back to her chair. "But Maman never can stick to one dance. So there were elements of the volta in the middle, and we finished with a minuet, didn't we?" Isabeau nodded and reached up to pat him on the cheek.
"You always were a good dancer," she said proudly.
"Ah, but not as good as you, and certainly not as good as father was," Matthew said, settling her into her chair.
Isabeau's eyes darkened, and a heartbreaking look of sadness crossed her face. Matthew picked up her hand and brushed his lips across her knuckles. Isabeau managed a small smile in return.
"Now it's your turn," he said, coming to me.
"I don't like to dance, Matthew," I protested, holding up my hands to fend him off. "I find that hard to believe," he said, taking my right hand in his left and drawing me close. "You contort your body into impossible shapes, skim across the water in a boat the width of a feather and ride like the wind. Dancing should be second nature." The next song sounded like something that might have been popular in Parisian dance halls in the 1920s. Notes of trumpet and drum filled the room.
"Mathieu, be careful with her,"
Isabeau warned as he moved me across the floor.
"She won't break, Maman."
Matthew proceeded to dance, despite my best efforts to put my feet in his way at every opportunity. With his right hand at my waist, he gently steered me into the proper steps. I started to think about where my legs were in an effort to help the process along, but this only made things worse. My back stiffened, and Matthew clasped me tighter. "Relax," he murmured into my ear. "You're trying to lead. Your job is to follow." "Can't," I whispered back, gripping his shoulder as if he were a life preserver. Matthew spun us around again. "Yes, you can. Close your eyes, stop thinking about it, and let me do the rest." Inside the circle of his arms, it was easy to do what he instructed. Without the whirling shapes and colors of the room coming at me from all directions, I could relax and stop worrying that we were about to crash. Gradually, the movement of our bodies in the darkness became enjoyable. Soon it was possible for me to concentrate not on what I was doing, but on what his legs and arms were telling me he was about to do. It felt like floating.
"Mathieu?"
Isabeau's voice held a note of caution.
"Le chatoiement?"
"I know," he murmured. The muscles in my shoulders tensed with concern. "Trust me," he said quietly into my ear. "I've got you." My eyes remained tightly closed, and I sighed happily. We continued to swirl together. Matthew gently released me, spinning me out to the end of his fingers, then rolled me back along his arm until I came to rest, my back tight against his chest. The music stopped.
"Open your eyes," he said softly.
My eyelids slowly lifted. The feeling of floating remained. Dancing was better than I had expected it to be. At least it was with a partner who'd been dancing for more than a millennium and never stepped on your toes. I tilted my face up to thank him, but his was much closer than expected.
"Look down," Matthew said.
Turning my head in the other direction revealed that my toes were dangling several inches above the floor. Matthew released me. He wasn't holding me up. I was holding me up. The air was holding me up. With that realization, the weight returned to the lower half of my body. Matthew gripped both elbows to keep my feet from smashing into the floor. From her seat by the fire, Mart hummed a tune under her breath. Isabeau's head whipped around, eyes narrowed. Matthew smiled at me reassuringly while I concentrated on the uncanny feeling of the earth under my feet. Had the ground always seemed so alive? It was as if a thousand tiny hands were waiting under the soles of my shoes to catch me or give me a push.
"Was it fun?" Matthew asked, as the last notes of Mart's song faded, eyes gleaming.
"It was," I answered, laughing, after considering his question.
"I hoped it would be. You've been practicing for years. Now maybe you'll ride with your eyes open for a change."
He caught me up in an embrace full of happiness and possibility. Isabeau began to sing the same song Mart had been humming. "Whoever sees her dance and her body move so gracefully could say, in truth, that in all the world she has no equal, our joyful queen. Go away. Go away, jealous ones. Let us dance together. Together."
Go away, jealous ones,"
Matthew repeated as the final echo of his mother's voice faded. "Let us dance together." I laughed again. "With you, I'll dance. But until I figure out how this flying business works, there will be no other partners."
"Properly speaking, you were floating, not flying," Matthew corrected me.
"Floating, flying, whatever you call it, it would be best not to do it with strangers."
"Agreed," he said.
Mart had vacated the sofa for a chair near Isabeau. Matthew and I sat together, our hands still entwined.
"This was her first time?"
Isabeau asked him, her voice genuinely puzzled.
"Diana doesn't use magic, Maman, except for little things," he explained.
"She is full of power, Mathieu. A witch's blood sings in her veins. She should be able to use it for big things, too."
He frowned. "It's hers to use or not."
"Enough of such childishness," she said, turning her attention to me. "It is time for you to grow up, Diana, and accept responsibility for who you are."
Matthew growled softly.
"Do not growl at me, Mathieu de Clermont. I am saying what needs to be said."
"You're telling her what to do. It's not your job."
"Nor yours, my son," Isabeau retorted.
"Excuse me." My sharp tone caught their attention, and the de Clermonts, mother and son, stared at me. "It's my decision whether and how to use my magic. But," I said, turning to Isabeau, "it can't be ignored any longer. It seems to be bubbling out of me. I need to learn how to control my power at the very least."
Isabeau and Matthew continued to stare. Finally, Isabeau nodded. Matthew did too.
We continued to sit by the fire until the logs burned down. Matthew danced with Mart, and each of them broke into song occasionally when a piece of music reminded them of another night by another fire. But I didn't dance again, and Matthew didn't press me. Finally, he stood. "I am taking the only one of us who needs her sleep up to bed." I stood as well, smoothing my trousers against my thighs. "Good night, Isabeau. Good night, Mart. Thank you both for a lovely dinner and a surprising evening."
Mart gave me a smile in return. Isabeau did her best, but managed only a tight grimace.
Matthew let me lead the way and put his hand gently against the small of my back as we climbed the stairs.
"I might read for a bit," I said, turning to face him when we reached his study. He was directly behind me, so close that the faint, ragged sound of his breath was audible. He took my face in his hands.
"What spell have you put on me?"
He searched my face.
"It's not simply your eyes, though they do make it impossible for me to think straight, or the fact that you smell like honey."
He buried his face in my neck, the fingers of one hand sliding into my hair while the other drifted down my back, pulling my hips toward him. My body softened into his, as if it were meant to fit there.
"It's your fearlessness," he murmured against my skin, "and the way you move without thinking, and the shimmer you give off when you concentrate, or when you fly."
My neck arched, exposing more flesh to his touch. Matthew slowly turned my face toward him, his thumb seeking out the warmth of my lips.
"Did you know your mouth puckers when you sleep? You look as though you might be displeased with your dreams, but I prefer to think you wish to be kissed."
He sounded more French with each word that he spoke. Aware of Isabeau's disapproving presence downstairs, as well as her acute, vampiric hearing, I tried to pull away. It wasn't convincing, and Matthew's arms tightened.
"Matthew, your mother..."
He gave me no chance to complete my sentence. With a soft, satisfied sound, he deliberately fitted his lips to mine and kissed me, gently but thoroughly, until my entire body, not just my hands, was tingling. I kissed him back, feeling a simultaneous sense of floating and falling until I had no clear awareness of where my body ended and his began. His mouth drifted to my cheeks and eyelids. When it brushed against my ear, I gasped. Matthew's lips curved into a smile, and he pressed them once more against my own.
"Your lips are as red as poppies, and your hair is so alive," he said when he was quite finished kissing me, with an intensity that left me breathless.
"What is it with you and my hair? Why anyone with a head of hair like yours would be impressed with this," I said, grabbing a fistful of it and pulling it, "is beyond me. Isabeau's hair looks like satin, so does Mart's. Mine is a mess. Every color of the rainbow and badly behaved as well."
"That's why I love it," Matthew said, gently freeing the strands. "It's imperfect, just like life. It's not vampire hair, or polished and flawless. I like that you're not a vampire, Diana."
"And I like that you are a vampire, Matthew." A shadow flitted across his eyes, gone in a moment.
"I like your strength," I said, kissing him with the same enthusiasm as he had kissed me. "I like your intelligence. Sometimes I even like your bossiness. But most of all..." I rubbed the tip of my nose gently against his. "I like the way you smell."
"You do?"
"I do." My nose went into the hollow between his collarbones, which I was fast learning was the spiciest, sweetest part of him.
"It's late. You need your rest."
He released me reluctantly.
"Come to bed with me."
His eyes widened with surprise at the invitation, and the blood coursed to my face. Matthew brought my hand to his heart. It beat once, powerfully.
"I will come up," he said, "but not to stay. We have time, Diana. You've known me for only a few weeks. There's no need to rush."
Spoken like a vampire. He saw my dejection and drew me closer for another lingering kiss.
"A promise," he said when he was finished, "of what's to come. In time."
It was time, but my lips were alternately freezing and burning, making me wonder for a fleeting second if I was as ready as I thought. Upstairs, the room was ablaze with candles and warm from the fire. How Mart had managed to get up here, change dozens of candles and light them so that they would still be burning at bedtime was a mystery, but the room didn't have a single electrical outlet, so I was doubly grateful for her efforts. Changing in the bathroom behind a partially closed door,
I listened to Matthew's plans for the next day. These involved a long walk, another long ride, and more work in the study. I agreed to all of it, provided that the work came first. The alchemical manuscript was calling to me, and I was eager to get a closer look at it. I got into Matthew's vast four-poster, and he tightened the sheets around my body before pinching out the candles. "Sing to me," I said, watching his long fingers fearlessly move through the flames. "An old song, one Mart likes." Her wicked fondness for love songs hadn't gone unnoticed. He was quiet for a few moments while he walked through the room, snuffing the candles and trailing shadows behind him as the room fell into darkness. He began to sing in his rich baritone.
Ni moi, ni vieux ne guaris. Ni mal nom sent et si la grande, quardes amour no suis devis. Ni no sai, j'en aurai ni quan. Ken lies est tuta les mercés, ken pot sorcer o decasser.
The song was full of yearning and teetered on the edge of sadness. By the time he returned to my side, the song was finished. Matthew left one candle burning next to the bed. "What do the words mean?" I reached for his hand.
"Not dying, nor living, nor healing. There is no pain in my sickness, for I am not kept from her love."
He leaned down and kissed me on the forehead. "I don't know if I will ever have it, for all the mercy that makes me flourish or decay is in her power." "Who wrote that?" I asked, struck by the aptness of the words when sung by a vampire.
"My father wrote it for Isabeau. Someone else took the credit, though," Matthew said, his eyes gleaming and his smile bright and content.
He hummed the song under his breath as he went downstairs. I lay in his bed, alone, and watched the last candle burn until it guttered out. Chapter 21 A vampire holding a breakfast tray greeted me the next morning after my shower. "I told Mart you wanted to work this morning," Matthew explained, lifting the cover that was keeping the food warm.
"You two are spoiling me."
I unfolded the napkin waiting on a nearby chair.
"I don't think your character is in any real danger."
Matthew stooped and gave me a lingering kiss, his eyes smoky. "Good morning. Did you sleep well?"
"Very well."
I took the plate from his hands, my cheeks reddening at the memory of the invitation I'd extended to him last night. There was still a twinge of hurt when I recalled his gentle rebuff, but this morning's kiss confirmed that we had slipped past the limits of friendship and were moving in a new direction. After my breakfast, we headed downstairs, turned on our computers, and got to work. Matthew had left a perfectly ordinary 19th-century copy of an early English translation of the Vulgate Bible on the table next to his manuscript.
"Thank you,"
I called over my shoulder, holding it up.
"I found it downstairs. Apparently the one I have isn't good enough for you,"
he grinned.
"I absolutely refuse to treat a Gutenberg Bible as a reference book, Matthew."
My voice came out more sternly than anticipated, making me sound like a schoolmarm.
"I know the Bible backwards and forwards. If you have a question, you could just ask me," he suggested. "I'm not using you as a reference book either."
"Suit yourself," he said with a shrug and another smile. With my computer at my side and an alchemical manuscript before me, I was soon absorbed in reading, analyzing, and recording my ideas. There was one distracting incident when I asked Matthew for something to weigh down the book's pages while I typed. He rummaged around and found a bronze medal with the likeness of Louis XIV on it, and a small wooden foot that he claimed came from a German angel. He wouldn't surrender the two objects without sureties for their return. Finally, he was satisfied by several more kisses. Aurora Consurgence was one of the most beautiful texts in the alchemical tradition, a meditation on the female figure of wisdom, as well as an exploration of the chemical reconciliation of opposing natural forces. The text in Matthew's copy was nearly identical to the copies I'd consulted in Zurich, Glasgow, and London, but the illustrations were quite different. The artist, Bourgault Lenoir, had been a true master of her craft. Each illumination was precise and beautifully executed. But her talent didn't lie simply in technical mastery. Her depictions of the female characters showed a different sensibility. Borgo's wisdom was full of strength, but there was a softness to her as well. In the first illumination, where wisdom shielded the personification of the seven metals in her cloak, she bore an expression of fierce, maternal pride. There were two illuminations, just as Matthew had promised, that weren't included in any known copy of Aurora Consurgence. Both appeared in the final parable, devoted to the chemical wedding of gold and silver. The first accompanied words spoken by the female principal in alchemical change, often represented as a queen dressed in white with emblems of the moon to show her association with silver. She had been transformed by Borgo into a beautiful, terrifying creature with silvery snakes instead of hair, her face shadowed like a moon eclipsed by the sun. Silently, I read the accompanying text, translating the Latin into English. "Turn to me with all your heart. Do not refuse me because I am dark and shadowed. The fire of the sun has altered me. The seas have encompassed me. The earth has been corrupted because of my work. Night fell over the earth when I sank into the miry deep, and my substance was hidden." The Moon Queen held a star in one outstretched palm. "From the depths of the water I cried out to you, and from the depths of the earth I will call to those who pass by me," I continued. "Watch for me. See me. And if you find another who is like me, I will give him the morning star." My lips formed the words, and Borgo's illumination brought the text to life in the Moon Queen's expression that showed both her fear of rejection and her shy pride. The second unique illumination came on the next page and accompanied the words spoken by the male principal, the Golden Sun King. The hair on my neck rose at Borgo's depiction of a heavy stone sarcophagus, its lid open just enough to reveal a golden body lying within. The king's eyes were closed peacefully, and there was a look of hope on his face as if he were dreaming of his release. "I will rise now and go about the city. In its streets I will seek out a pure woman to marry," I read, "her face beautiful, her body more beautiful, her raiment most beautiful. She will roll away the stone from the entrance of my tomb and give me the wings of a dove so that I might fly with her to the heavens to live forever and be at rest." The passage reminded me of Matthew's badge from Bethany and Lazarus's tiny silver coffin. I reached for the Bible. "Mark 16, Psalms 55 and Deuteronomy 32, verse 40. Matthew's voice cut through the quiet, spouting references like an automated biblical concordance.
"How did you know what I was reading?"
I twisted in my chair to get a better view of him. "Your lips were moving," he replied, staring fixedly at his computer screen, his fingers clattering on the keys. Pressing my lips together, I returned to the text. The author had drawn on every biblical passage that fit the alchemical story of death and creation, paraphrasing and cobbling them together. I pulled the Bible across the desk. It was bound in black leather, and a gold cross adorned the cover. Opening it to the Gospel of Mark, I scanned chapter 16. There it was. Mark chapter 16, verse 3. "And they said to one another, 'Who shall roll us back the stone from the door of the sepulchre?'"
"Find it?" Matthew inquired mildly.
"Yes."
"Good."
The room grew silent once more.
"Where is the verse about the morning star?"
Sometimes my pagan background was a serious professional liability. "Revelation 2, verse 28.
"Thank you."
"My pleasure." A smothered laugh came from the other desk. I bent my head to the manuscript and ignored it. After 2 hours of reading tiny Gothic handwriting and searching for corresponding biblical references, I was more than ready to go riding when Matthew suggested it was time for a break. As an added bonus, he promised to tell me over lunch how he knew the 17th century physiologist William Harvey.
"It's not a very interesting story," Matthew had protested.
"Maybe not to you, but to a historian of science, it's the closest thing I'll get to meeting the man who figured out that the heart is a pump." We hadn't seen the sun since we'd arrived at Settur, but neither of us minded. Matthew seemed more relaxed, and I was surprisingly happy to be out of Oxford. Gillian's threats, the pictures of my parents, even Peter Knox, they all receded with each hour that passed. As we walked out into the gardens, Matthew chatted animatedly about a problem at work that involved a missing strand of something that should have been present in a blood sample but wasn't. He sketched out a chromosome in the air in an effort to explain, pointing to the offending area, and I nodded even though what was at stake remained mysterious. The words continued to roll out of his mouth, and he put an arm around my shoulder, drawing me close. We rounded a line of hedges. A man in black stood outside the gate we'd passed through yesterday on our ride. The way he leaned against a chestnut tree, with the elegance of a leopard on the prowl, suggested he was a vampire.